Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of America's Conservative Podcast. I am your host, Ed Denzel. I hope everybody is having a beautiful week. You should know, as I am going to record this, there was a kind of chase. I don't know if there was technically a shootout, but there was a police chase in the Capitol area, near the Capitol. Does not look like it was terrorist-related. In fact, it was a woman. Not saying that women don't commit terrorist acts. They do. There are, of course, one of the shooters for the San Bernardino terrorism attack was a woman. But it doesn't look like this would happen this morning near the Capitol was a terrorist act. It seemed like maybe somebody just, whether the woman was drinking and driving or driving erratically, or it was, I think it was more something like that. Of course, me, the way I am, when I hear a story like this, I automatically think that it probably is one of my ex-girlfriends, but not that I have any that lives in the Washington, D.C. area. A little bit of a joke there, but nobody got killed. The woman is in custody. No policemen got killed. No innocent people got killed or hurt. And that's the important part. So that's why I feel I can make a little bit of a joke about it. Did any of you watch the soccer match last night between the United States and Panama? I will tell you, I watched the entire thing. I was doing some work, but I did have it on. And it's, you just really wonder, if you don't know, the United States got rid of their last coach just a couple months ago, a German. His name was Jurgen Klinsmann, who I think when he first got in there did a good job. But and I really don't follow. If the United States isn't playing, I don't watch soccer at all. And I'm not that big of a fan, but I will support my country and I'll watch this stuff just like I watched the baseball in the United States were playing, was playing. And he just, Jurgen Klinsmann, I think, improved the team. Then he started to do some weird things. But you really wonder, you know, the soccer in the United States, I mean, it's obviously behind basketball, baseball, and football. It's behind hockey. It's behind motor sports like NASCAR or anything like that. It's behind golf. And you might even be able to pick a couple other sports or hobbies that people have regarding competition that soccer is behind. And I don't know if that's ever going to change. I don't know. And we're going to talk about the NFL a little bit today, I think, before this program is over. But I think that's the reason. I mean, they played Panama. United States and Panama tied 1-1. I think if you put in the teams that the United States has to compete against in getting into the World Cup, the United States is very lucky that it isn't in Europe and had to compete against Germany and France and England and Italy and Portugal and Spain to get into World Cup, because the United States would never get in. Ever. Belgium, I mean, Netherlands, I mean, they all have excellent, excellent national teams. The United States would never get in. If the United States was in South America against Brazil and Argentina and those teams, Uruguay, they would never get in. We are very lucky that we are in this part of the world, and all these divisions are created this way, that the United States has an easier trip to get in, especially considering we are playing teams whose population of their countries is far less than the United States. And in fact, I forget what the population of Mexico is now. I know Mexico City is what the most populated city in the world. It's huge. But I think that if you combined the populations of all the other teams the United States has to play to get into the World Cup, in what would that be, 2000, is it next year, 2018? The population wouldn't equal the United States, I don't think. That's how small these are. Maybe you would take out Mexico, but it has to be close. I didn't add it all up. But that just shows you how much of an underachiever we are in soccer, that we have a population of 330 million, and we can't blow out a team from Panama. Why? Well, mainly because American children don't grow up with soccer being their number one sport. That's very, very rare. And then on top of that, our best athletes in the United States go into different sports. Those other ones I just mentioned. So I don't know if the coach matters. I'm not sure what all has to happen, but they've been working at this for a long time, and soccer just doesn't stick in the United States. Americans only watch soccer for the most part. If the United States team is playing and if their kids are playing, I think that's about it for a large majority of the population. But if the United States is playing, I'll watch it just to see what happens. Let's get to the show. Where do I want to start? Well, let's start here. Brexit is going to happen. We haven't talked about Brexit recently. We haven't talked about it, I guess, too much since the vote happened last year, not long before our presidential election. And there was a surprise that the people in Britain voted for Britain to leave. Ex-Britain, exit, put it together, Brexit. It was close, but it was a surprise. It was 52% of the people wanted to leave, and 48% of the people wanted to stay. The reason that the people wanted to leave mostly was because of immigration and the EU's, European Union's, attitude toward letting all of these people in, meaning that Britain had to, England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland all had to let in people too, took it out of their hands, what they could do on their own, was that. And I think to a lesser extent, but still considerable extent, the whole economic situation that has gone on in Europe the last 10 years since we had our crisis in the United States with the real estate market. Although Europe's problems are different from our own. With Greece and the bailouts and all of this, countries not being able to print their own money and control their own currency. And I think eventually that kind of war on Britain as well, even though England continued to use the pound, it was very much entwined with what was going on, of course, in the rest of the European Union, and they were using the euro. And I think that wore thin after a while as well. They wanted to have more control over their economic future than they had at that point. But once again, I think this was to a lesser extent. I think more of it had to do with all of these stories about Syrian refugees and other people from the Middle East coming into these countries. I think I told you that a guy I used to do some independent filmmaking with back in the mid-2000s, he got married, and I forget what year it was, 2005, I'm going to guess, something like that. For his honeymoon, his uncle paid for him and his wife to go to England. That's where they went for their honeymoon. He always wanted to go. He said he would go on streets there and you didn't even know that you were in London. Could not tell for a second. Nobody's speaking English. Not even seeing any English words. And this was 12 years ago, approximately, somewhere around there. And so I can only guess that it's gotten worse since then. And I think probably that's part of it. And I don't even think that it's necessarily a racial thing. I think that obviously a majority of people living in Britain, those four countries, they're not countries technically, they're all together, but England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, overall, they decided that they didn't want to have anything to do with that anymore. Now, you should know that breaking down the Brexit vote, a majority of people in England and Wales voted for Brexit, but a majority of people in Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to stay. So that adds another wrinkle into this that we'll get to in a bit. So that has also made it difficult. And this is something that the new Prime Minister, Theresa May, is trying to figure out what's going to happen with all of that once Britain exits the EU and how to manage Scotland and Northern Ireland in particular. The big issue, I think, for the European Union is this isn't like Luxembourg leaving the EU. Luxembourg's surely in the EU. But it's not like one of these smaller countries that's leaving the EU. And I should say that I think the main reason this was so easy, and although relatively easy, for them to come up with this vote to leave, to even get the vote was something. To even get it on a ballot somewhere in England that everybody would come out and vote either way on this is something. That was something in and of itself. And then nobody surely thought that a majority would vote to leave, but they did. It made it kind of easy for them, being that they're not connected to the European continent, that they're separated by the English Channel. That is something. I think that matters. Even though I know that whether by jet or by high-speed train or by ship, people can easily get from France to England, from Germany to England, from any of these countries to England fairly quickly. I think being separated by a decent-sized body of water where people can't just take a regular train or a car between the countries, I think it matters. And I think that may be why England, Britain, whatever you want to call it, I know I get confused on that a little bit. Maybe overall, even totally, was not part of the EU anyway. Because there's definitely a difference, at least what I understand it to be. There's definitely a difference between England, as I understand it, Great Britain, and the European continent. One of the big differences is that, you know, the Brits, they're much more like us than they are like Europeans, in that most of them can only speak one language. This is a factor of them living on an island. Everybody there speaks English. Even the Scots speak English now. Even the Irish speak English now. The Northern Irish, they speak English now. Whereas if you go to Europe, and I've never been there, but I think I know enough about it to know, you go to Europe and most people speak two or three different languages and one of them just happens to be English. Most of your French people can speak French and English. They hate English because they're snobs, but a lot of them do know how to speak it. Germans, Italians, they'll figure out how to speak English. Whereas in England, they get away with never having to learn another language. Kind of like we in the United States have gotten away with just speaking English, and that's it. That's it. If the United States was like Europe and it was broken up into, say, instead of 50 states, 50 countries, and each of them had their different languages, then you'd find Americans or Pennsylvanians or Floridians speaking Alabaman or South Carolinian or something. But the British have never had to do that, whereas the Europeans on the continent have. I think that that matters. I think that the language, language can be a very tribal thing because it's very easy for people to communicate with each other. And when you don't know another language, there's no way to feel more disconnected from somebody else than not understanding what the person is saying. I think that matters. I think that all adds up. I think that was underestimated when the vote was taken last year. Even though Great Britain had been part of the old school EU since 1973, of course, the euro, which really started to define the European Union with everybody going to one currency, is really when people, I think, start to really accept that that's when the European Union really started. But actually, technically, it started in the 1970s with other kinds of deals. But it was the euro coming along that really put it on the map, I guess. And now England wants out of it. What I was going to say before is this isn't just like some little country leaving. Those countries combined between England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, they make up one-fifth of the world economy. One-fifth. And that's a big deal. And it's not like Greece was leaving. It's not like one of these other countries were they to be leaving. And what'll be interesting to see is the European Union going to make an example of Britain leaving, meaning really, really hammer them hard for what they're doing? Because it's kind of like the European Union, even though it's bigger, has more people, has more economic might as a whole than Britain does now. The European Union is now in the dealings probably a disadvantage. Because either way that they go is probably going to hurt it. Because on one hand, if they're too nice, because say the European Union decides, well, you know, we really need to still get along with Britain because, well, those Brits, they do have a lot of money compared to most of us on this continent. We want them coming to Europe for vacations and for business and everything. And we still want to do that, even though they're not part of the European Union. If the European Union does that, then some of these other countries might start thinking, well, what the heck? Why is it that Britain gets to leave and not pay any penalty? They'll start thinking, well, maybe we should leave too. If we're going to get our butts kissed, if it's almost going to be like being in the European Union but not being in it without having to pay all these dues and everything else, then we don't want to be part of it either. It's no different, I guess you'd say, like in a college situation, like if you have a fraternity. And maybe there are some guys that are outside of the fraternity that are always going, that have friends who are in the fraternity. And these guys get to come over and hang out at the parties and meet all the chicks and drink all the beer. But they never have to pay for the rent on the frat house. They never have to pay pitch in for dues. They never have to pitch in for maintenance or anything else. They just get all the perks and none of this, all the upside and none of the downside. And this is kind of what's like going on in the European Union could be. Is Britain's going to have all the upside with none of the downside, and the European Union has, well, if we treat them too badly, if we treat them too nicely because we need them, then other people will want to just be a part of it but not be a part of it as well. On the other hand, if the European Union is too hard on England and the Britain, those four states, I guess we're going to just call them that, then they risk those people not coming to Europe, and it only would cause the European Union to spiral down faster, which I happen to believe is eventually where this is always going to go anyway. I really believe that eventually, not today, not tomorrow, not next year, I think that some of these countries are going to figure out this is more of a problem than it's worth. I'm not saying they'll just totally go back to being totally separate countries, going back to the 1950s, even though that'd be a little difficult, but because we'd have all those Soviet bloc states in Eastern Europe that are now part of the EU, but you know what I mean. I'm not saying they're going to go back to that, but I do see a day when a lot of these countries are going to say, we're not going to use the euro anymore. We're going to control our own currency. Thank you very much. We're going to control our own immigration. Thank you very much. I could see those two big changes happening. And see, once that starts to happen, then I think it'll just be like dominoes, to use a cliche, that one by one, this will happen. So I think the European Union is screwed either way. If they're too nice to Britain, it'll just cause other countries to say, well, you know what? If that's as bad as it gets, then maybe we don't want to be a part of it either. That looks pretty favorable to us. But if it's too bad, then the European Union is going to hurt itself for trade and all these other things. You know, defense of each other, all of that. This is why I don't see a good end for any of this. But like I said before, I think Theresa May, as prime minister, she is going to have her own issues just within Britain, within England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. Because Northern Ireland and Scotland, they want to be, at least at this point, still part of the EU, and they're not. And that's trouble. That's trouble. And I got to tell you this. I remember going back to when, you know, Scotland just a few years ago tried to separate from Britain. It wanted to become its own truly independent country. And I was against that. What do they care what I think? I'm just some stupid American who's probably never going to go to England or Scotland or any of these places anyway. I really just don't care to see them. I just don't. It's just me. But I thought that they should stay because of many different reasons. Many different reasons. Now, this is something I think that is going to be very, very difficult to square. We're going to really find out how passionate Scots are about wanting to be a part of the EU and being part of Britain. I think it's going to come down to they are going to have to pick one. Even though they voted to stay, a majority of Scots voted to stay in England, they're not going to be able to have it both ways now. And so that vote, I hear that the separatist movement is now building steam again because of Brexit, and that makes sense. Makes sense. It's really going to come down to you either want to be part of the EU or you want to be a part of Britain. And that is going to be very, very interesting. Now, for Northern Ireland, it may be not quite as interesting because, once again, we have a body of water involved. Northern Ireland is on its own continent, or it's on its own island with Ireland. Ireland is its own independent country. And by the way, if you don't know, Ireland is not part of NATO, if you didn't know that. But Northern Ireland is separated from Wales, England, and Scotland. And so it's going to have some tough decisions to make as well. I personally think eventually these countries, I think they're going to probably test it out. These separatists who in Scotland who still want to leave Britain, want to leave England and become autonomous. I think they're going to be watching what goes on in the EU after Britain is definitely 100% severed. And they're going to go with whichever one is going to be more powerful and is going to be beneficial to them. And so it could be that if they have another separatist vote, it could be that a lot of these people, they may think, you know what, I want to be part of the EU, and I know that I voted for separation of England before, but I'm not sure I want to be part of the EU either because I think England's actually going to be more powerful eventually in all this. And so some people who voted for separation of Scotland and England before may choose to stay with England instead of the EU. It's all going to get very, very interesting. And even though it doesn't have a lot to do with the United States, I happen to continue to think that all these people who wanted Britain to stay in the EU and they said doomsday Armageddon if it doesn't, I think that's all overblown. However, on the other side, I think that the people who wanted to exit the EU have also overblown how great it's going to be. I think it was the right thing to do. I think it was. But it all depends what you do with that newfound independence and autonomy that matters. And that's where my concerns start. Now, we do, I mean, to a much, much lesser extent, and I don't believe this is going to happen, but it's worth talking about. There's a movement in California, and I've talked about this at least once before within the last 6 months, about California, some people there, threatening to leave the United States. Totally, totally different situation than England or Britain leaving the EU. Totally different situation. Even though I know that California is our most populous state, and if it was its own country, what would it be? The seventh largest economy in the world just on its own, California, even with all of the issues and problems and earthquakes and blackouts and that Orville Dam is situation that's still continuing. Everything put together and all the wackos that live there, it's still a very powerful economic force. It is. But the difference is that California relies way more on the other 50 states and relies more on the federal government of the United States than I think England and Britain, start using the right term, Britain relied on the EU. I think that, let's put it this way, if the people of Britain were getting social security checks and all of that from the EU, then there is no way it votes to separate from the EU. There's just no way that happens. I doubt you would even gotten one vote. It wouldn't even come to a vote. They would have said, well, you know, if you separate from the EU, all those benefits, those entitlements you're getting from the EU, those are going to go away. It wouldn't even come to vote. It would never even occur to anybody. This is why I think that all of this California talk in the end is going to go nowhere. I think that too many of those people would figure out how much it's going to hurt them in their pocketbook. In addition, the force that the rest of the 49 states could exert on California would be considerable. A lot more than if the force that Germany and France and Italy and the rest of them could exert on England. It's not even close. It's not even close. And that's why the California exit is never going to happen. This is just a bunch of people who don't like the way the last election went. I mean, what's confusing about all this regarding California's people talking? They're all a bunch of leftists. They are getting everything their own way in that state. Every single thing that goes on in that state goes in a liberal direction. Guns, abortion, marijuana, you name it, it has gone in a liberal direction, and they're still not happy. Still not happy. So that's why I think that eventually somebody is going to wake up and say, wait a minute, guys, this is crazy. Do we really want to separate from a country where we just had a presidential election where the person that our state voted for, electoral votes, won by 3 million votes, and we want to separate from that country? We realize that that woman, Hillary Clinton, didn't win. But she won by 3 million of the popular vote. I think it's best that we stay here and try to change things on our own instead of becoming our own country or whatever we want to do. Not to mention that if California tried to exit, I think that you'd have a bunch of people who wanted to stay in the United States, the 49 states, I guess, move the heck out of that country. You'd probably have half the population of California, even though a lot of those two would be Democrats. They'd probably get the heck out if they found out one day they were going to wake up and it was the country of California instead of the state of California. So, and that would be easy to do. Why? Because we're in the United States and you can be a citizen everywhere. You're not a citizen of Florida. You're not a citizen of South Carolina. You're a citizen of the United States. Whereas in the EU, you're still a citizen of Italy. You're not a citizen of the European Union. That's what also makes this very different. And that's probably what has kept a lot of people in Britain from moving to Germany and all of these other countries because they're not citizens there. Whereas in the United States, if California's people decided, hey, we're getting the heck out, these people could say, well, you know what? I'll just pick up and move to Idaho and Nevada and Colorado or Arizona. And in that alone would greatly hurt California. California's not going anywhere. I got to go to the break. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.
The voice of American conservatism, WRS Digital, Red State Talk Radio.
And we are back at America's Conservative Podcast. Let's move on to something else. Newt, he's kind of hard to track these days. My buddy Dave sent me something a few days ago about Newt, and Dave knows that I've been a fan of Newt Gingrich's for a long time. And of course, I think conservatives of my age, around my generation, I guess maybe between 43, 44, and probably 55, Newt Gingrich has left a mark on all of us, really because of what the age that we were when he took over Congress. And it was around the age when a lot of people start paying attention to politics. You know, 1994, I was 24 at the time. I was out of college, had been a conservative, went to a conservative school. And he and what he did, Contract with America, has left a mark on all of us. A good mark. I should say a good mark. A very good mark. And I guess my respect for him, even though, and I've been critical of him since he's jumped on the Trump train, you know I've said that, but I did vote for him in the primaries in 2012. I did not vote for Mitt Romney here in Florida, in the primaries at least. So anytime that he speaks, it gets my attention, and my buddy Dave knows that. I think Dave feels the very much the same way I do about Newt, at least has historically that I have. And so he'd sent me something about how Newt says we need to put Obamacare to the side and Trump needs to get that infrastructure bill passed, which infrastructure talk is not conservative talk. Constitutionally and the way our government works, yes, it is true that the government is responsible for roads and bridges, although I primarily think that that is mostly a state thing. Because, you know, each state has its own Department of Transportation. But it was the federal government that came up with a highway system in the 1950s under Dwight Eisenhower. Speaking of which, Kevin Williamson at National Review had an excellent article about Dwight Eisenhower. I think everybody should go read it. Kind of the forgotten president, almost. We talk about all these other guys. We talk about FDR. We talk about Harry Truman because he dropped the bomb. Talk about JFK because he got assassinated. We talk about LBJ because of the Great Society, and we know about Richard Nixon, all that. And suddenly, everybody just seems to skip over Dwight Eisenhower because it seemed to be a boring time in American history. And you look into it, and it wasn't. Yes, the Korean War, but there was a lot of other things as well. But the highway system in the 1950s. So it's kind of turned into a federal job when we start talking about fixing roads, fixing bridges, if they truly need fixed. But Dave sent me that about how, you know, Newt said we need to get onto this infrastructure bill and get this economy going and everything. And I jokingly said back, you know, and he said, "Your boy, Newt." And I said to Dave, I said, "Well, if Newt's my boy, then he's out of the will." So, we have the development. Now Newt is out there speaking well of the Freedom Caucus. It's so hard to track this guy. And see, this is one of the minuses of Newt Gingrich. He has this huge brain, very creative guy. I think that had he not gotten into politics for whatever, if he'd done something else, he probably would have been an excellent, Although I know he has done some fiction books, right? A novel. I know he's done some books, but probably would have been a great screenwriter. Probably would have been a great movie director. Just this crazy, crazy genius along the lines of Stanley Kubrick. That's the way I see Newt Gingrich if he ever became a director. That's who he would be. He wouldn't be a Steven Spielberg type. He'd be a Stanley Kubrick type. Just mad genius, you know. But you need to control some of that when it gets into politics. And this is why, at times, it seems like Newt Gingrich just is, you know, just going off on all these crazy tangents. But now he's saying that the Freedom Caucus did a very good thing in blocking this bill. You know, so 1 week you hate him, or for months you hate him, because of him cozying up to Donald Trump as much as he had, although to his credit, Newt Gingrich said that he wouldn't take a cabinet position. I've told you why. I still believe this. And I've been saying this even before the election happened, when there were rumors about who was going to be a cabinet member should Trump win. Of course, at that time, the odds seemed very low that he was going to win. But Newt had been saying since back then he wouldn't take a cabinet position. And I said, well, probably because he thinks that if Trump became president, it's eventually going to be a disaster. And Newt wants an easy way out. He wants to be able to get out the back door without ever officially having a title in the administration. He just wants to be influential, but he doesn't want a title to go along with it. Which, once again, seems like a very Newt Gingrich thing to do. And in fact, dare I say it, that would probably be a very Ed Densel thing to do regarding many things in my life. I want to give advice, but I don't want to officially be on the record with any title or anything. That is my life. So he's right. The Freedom Caucus did save the Republicans. Now, the reason that Newt says that he saved the Republican Party, the House and the Republican Party, is because the bill, as he states, if you want to believe the polls, only had a 17% approval rating among the American people. Even though the American people want something done about their health care, they did not have a very favorable view of this bill. And Newt cites Obamacare, and how people had a very negative idea, even though people back then wanted something, allegedly wanted something done about their health care. What was pushed through was something that was a majority of the American people were not a fan of. The Democrats pushed it through anyway, and we know what happened in the midterms in 2010. And so what Newt is saying is that by the Freedom Caucus stopping this vote, they might have actually saved the midterms for the Republicans, which is an interesting way to think about it. And as I've told you, and I think that what Newt is saying is that nothing is guaranteed in any of this. Just because the midterms and, you know, the way everything is districted right now, it's favorable to the Republicans. In the Senate, the states where senators are running are favorable Republican states. That doesn't mean anything. Anything can happen. And I think that's what Newt is saying in this, is that you don't want to pass something just because. And this could have long-term effects, and most of those effects would not be on health care. And he's right. He's right. He also points out that it took a long time, and I just said this a few days ago, and this is not an original thought. This has been written a few different places, that it took several months for the Democrats to put Obamacare together and try to get it through this way and get it through that way before they decided on what they were going to do, and that was essentially force it through the House and get the Senate to vote on it. And, of course, that's where Nancy Pelosi had said you have to vote on it before you get to find out what's in it. And here the Republicans were trying to ram through something, a new bill, not a repeal kind of thing, which, as we're finding out more and more that repeal of Obamacare would be a lot easier than it's made out to be. And you can get all conspiracy theory why everybody thinks it's so difficult. but it can be done. Of course, Ted Cruz pointed out a way, but I've heard some other people talking about the interpretation of the rules in the Senate could be done this way, could be done that way. It's not as impossible as some people have made it out to be, and I'm starting to believe that those people who've been selling that it would be practically impossible because you need a majority are those people who voted for repeal back in 2015 but didn't really mean it. I'm starting to believe that rumor was created by them. But either way, whether it takes 2 months or a day or 6 months, you need to. What I think the American people want, your average American who is not as conservative as I am, I think your average American wants the government with the regulate what it has to do with regulation or Obamacare or across state lines. They want to see that it's going in a positive direction where costs are going to go down, choices are going to go up. In addition, there are going to be mechanisms in the private sector, not the public sector, but in the private sector on their own to handle patients who right now are part of insurance companies and who insurance companies wouldn't take if these new laws from Obamacare weren't in place. See, I think on one hand, your average American feels bad for these people with these horrible illnesses and diseases that are no fault of something they did. So a lot of it is just genetic, and it sucks. It sucks. And every American, including myself, knows that. On the other hand, I think that your average American realizes that there is something wrong when the federal government forces companies to take on customers that are going to put them out of business. We have to find somewhere in all of that a happy medium in all of that. That's what I think the average American wants. The people who – see, I realize that I probably am never going to get my way in my lifetime. I admit that. I think I know the way healthcare should work, and it doesn't involve the federal government. It may involve a little bit of state government, maybe, but it relies mainly on doctors and nurses and people who have devoted their lives to the medical profession, along with nonprofit organizations and choice and free markets and everything. I don't know if I'm ever going to get to that dream, and I'll be fine with that. But what we're doing now can't continue, and anything that goes in any other direction than what my dream is, I think is wrong. And if you're going to do something, you have to do something that's right, whether it takes a day or 2 months or 6 months or a year. And I think what the American people decided is that this is the wrong bill, and this is something that seems like it was hastily thrown together. And it's not really anytime soon probably going to save us any money. I think the average American who has been paying attention to any of this knows that. In addition, I think that there are a lot of people who, like I've said, if this bill had been introduced a year ago and said, you know what, when Donald Trump becomes president, this is the bill that we're going to put up to fight against Obamacare, many voters would have said, what? You're going to do, that is the best you can do. And I think there was a lot of that going on here. And I think that the Freedom Caucus felt that. I don't think that the other people who opposed it felt that. Those moderates who I think probably voted for the repeal back in 2015 when Barack Obama was president probably dread the day if Ted Cruz brings that bill back. But I told you before the inauguration happened that I think that Obamacare should be at the top of the list. Obamacare repeal should be at the top of the list. I did not say that a bill that kind of sort of like maybe, possibly, not even, not probably, might do something and that is the first thing they should do and they should push it through and there should be all this infighting. I didn't say that. What I said is we need to get to a situation where we go back to the way it was in, say, 2007 and work from there. That's what I would be working for. Even as a conservative, but if I was a politician, that's what I would be working for. I would go back to whatever the language and everything that was going on before Obamacare was enacted, and then work on something from there. That's what I would work to. And that's every speech that I would give. I want to go back to the way it was right before Obamacare and fix it from there. I want to erase the last 8 years of Obamacare. And then once that happens, I'm willing to listen to anybody who has suggestions on what we can do about more choice. And for these people who have been rejected by insurance companies, I'm willing to talk to anybody about any of that. I'm willing to do a lot. But I'm not going to use the force of the federal government to do it. I'm going to talk a lot about the private sector. I'm going to talk a lot about doctors and nurses. I'm going to try to put those people who have been rejected by insurance companies in contact with nonprofit organizations and doctors and specialists who can look at these people and get to know them. That's what I'm willing to do. That's what I'm willing to do. But I'm not, as a representative or a senator, I'm never going to introduce a bill that forces a private company to take on customers that are going to put them out of business. I'm never going to do that. All I want to do at first is get back to 2000, 2007, 2008, back to a territory that we all remember, that we all understand, but we also know needs work. That's what should be done. And that should have been the speech given since the first day that Donald Trump became president. We're only going one way. And that is back to what it was before Obamacare. That means repeal. And then we can talk about anything that you want to do. I'm not saying I'll agree with a lot of it, but we can talk. We'll talk. And I'll listen, and hopefully you'll listen to me, and we'll figure something out. Just so you know what my prerequisites are. But that wasn't done. That wasn't done. Mainly, I put this on listening to the Commentary Magazine podcast from Monday. They look at it the same way that I do. In fact, I did a show before I even heard what they said, saying that this is mostly on Donald Trump. They agree with me. They agree with me. The reason being, as I've stated, that bill never gets even started if Ted Cruz or some conservative, more conservative person is president. They don't even think about it. Because they know that a Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or one of those other people who were Republican possibilities would sign it. They introduced that bill because they thought that was the only kind of bill that Donald Trump would sign. Why? Because of all the statements that Donald Trump has made about health care since he started running for president. I still believe that. So, Newt Gingrich is probably right. I think that the Freedom Caucus did save the Republicans in the short term. Didn't do anything to repeal Obamacare. Of course, this bill wasn't going to do it either. But I think that they saved the Republicans for what seemed like was going to be a long-term problem, I think. Might have seemed like a short-term fix. Everybody would get to brag, look what we did. In the end, though, I think it would have been a long-term problem that would have hurt healthcare, and it would have hurt conservatives not just in Congress, but your average people in the United States as well. Let's move on to something else. I told you I was going to talk about the NFL. And I got about 5 minutes left. It looks like the Oakland Raiders are going to become the Las Vegas Raiders in a few years. Now, the funny thing is that the Raiders are going to stay in Oakland for the next couple years. I wonder how many fans they're going to get to show up for games. Because if you remember, if you think about the past when teams have moved, they do it quite quickly. I mean, there are all sorts of horror stories about how quickly the Colts left Baltimore for Indianapolis. And how quickly the Browns left Cleveland to become the Ravens in Baltimore. Just pick up and left. One season they were in Cleveland, next season they were in Baltimore. One season they were in Baltimore, one next season they were in Indianapolis. And in there, that time, Baltimore actually had a Canadian Football League team. Yeah, look it up. It's a true story. But this is something that sounds like it's going to take some time, mainly because because Las Vegas does not have an NFL-proof stadium. They do have a football stadium where UNLV plays, but not sure it's really can be used for, at least it doesn't sound like they want to use it for the Raiders, should the Raiders just want to move now and start in September. This is going to be a mistake. Having been a Las Vegas resident, an experienced season Las Vegas resident for 13 and a half years, the problem they're going to have is that Las Vegas is not that big of a place. Have like 2 million people in Southern Nevada. That's it. And you have a couple little towns. You have St. George up into Utah, which is about an hour and a half away, but it's not, it's a little tiny rinky dink city. I don't know how many people there, but it's not very big. I don't even know if they even have as 100,000 people. You know, Las Vegas, it's not like Pittsburgh. It's not like Philadelphia where you have the city and then you have all these suburbs of people that you can get to come to the games, you know, once a year, once every couple years. It's either you live in Las Vegas or you don't live anywhere near it. The nearest large city, I mean, Phoenix is like 4.5 hours away. Of course, it already has its own football team. You have Baker, California, which is at least a couple hours, like halfway between Las Vegas and LA, but it's not a very big city either. I just don't know where they're going to get these people to come from. And if they're relying on people from the casino kind of give these games out as comps for people to go to an NFL game, you know what? In September and October in Las Vegas, it's hot. Now, maybe they're going to have a dome. Maybe that'll help. They're going to have a dome. But my instincts also tell me people don't go to Las Vegas to watch a football game. You know, what are they going to do? Gamble, lose a couple $1,000s at the Bellagio, and then the Bellagio comps them a couple tickets to an NFL game? Really? You have to realize something. Even though Las Vegas is glitz and glamour, and there are rich people that live there and all that, Las Vegas is a very middle-class city. Now, the good thing about Las Vegas is you don't need a very high education to make good money there. And that's one of the things that will probably always be good about Las Vegas. And it's all good. That's great. From servers to valets to all of these different jobs that you, once again, you don't need higher education to do, but pay well through the tips and everything else. But it's very middle class. And these tickets are going to be expensive. I think this, and on top of that, the whole tax thing that they're going to, you know, it's going to play with public money. This is not good. I personally think we've seen peak NFL in the United States. I think it's all downhill. I really do. I do. I'll live. I like baseball better. But I got to go. You can find me or find the show Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern on the Prime Channel and RedStateTalkRadio.com. Find the show also on Podomatic and iTunes, USA Podcast, the Twitter account. My other program, Missing Persons Program Unfound, find it on Podomatic and iTunes. Maybe you'll like it. I got to go. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.